Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for people who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying with multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which sadly included pregnancy loss, last year I was finally pregnant, and now I'm finally parenting my gorgeous daughter, Ren. Hello, hello. How are you doing? So, Sunday was Mother's Day. For those of you who are trying to conceive, I know that you might be sighing a huge sigh of relief right now that it's over for another year. And I totally, totally get that. For those pregnant and parenting, I truly hope that you had the most fabulous day. I know for those of us that are lucky enough still to have our mums around, we won't necessarily have been able to see them, but I hope that you had a lovely day nonetheless. And I am recording this a little bit ahead of time, so it hasn't actually happened yet, but I'm hoping that I had a wonderful day as well. Fingers crossed, all being well, it should be. Before I go on about today's episode or anything else, I want to tell you a little bit about my yoga sessions course in case that you haven't come across them before. The yoga sessions is a 4-week virtual yoga course for those who are finally pregnant. I work with some amazing yoga teachers who get it, like they know and they understand. And with them, we have created a space that combines community, support, and yoga, and it is really, really very special. If you want to know more, you can head to katstrawbridge.com/events. There's a link in the show notes. Just a word of warning, the courses do sell out month after month. So assuming you feel ready to book, and I absolutely do not want anyone to feel pressure to do so, if you feel ready and that is what you want to do, then I do recommend doing it sooner rather than later. If you will indulge me a little right now, I want to read one of the messages that I receive. And I do receive messages regularly from the people who join the courses. They absolutely love it. And I'm not saying it's a special place because that's just my thought. It is because this is what I hear from people. But this one is important because it was sent to me by someone who has a visual impairment due to a condition called Stargardt's. They say, loved Monday's class. I found Amelie to be so helpful. She even changed matte colour this week to make it higher contrast for me so I could see better. It was so helpful that she switched mattes. And the thing that I like most is that she reached out to me herself and asked if there was anything she could do to help me. Starting the conversation means you feel okay about asking. And that was really, really special because A, it just, you know, confirms that I have got the most amazing yoga teachers working with me. And also because it is a clear example that the yoga sessions are accessible not only to people all over the world because it's virtual, but they are also accessible for people who are living with a disability. And honestly, like I say, the yoga teachers are incredible at making sure everyone feels as comfortable as they possibly can from a pregnancy point of view and beyond. So if you are pregnant right now, I just, yeah, head over and find out more and always contact me with any questions at all. Right. So what's going on with me? The podcast has been shortlisted as Podcast of the Year in the Digital Women Awards, which is very exciting. More information on that to come. I have also been accepted onto a Women in Business mentorship scheme run by the Bank Santander, which I'm really excited about from a personal point of view and from the point of view of growing the support that I provide. So it's a really, really exciting time. And on that, every time you listen to the podcast, subscribe, rate, or review it, you are helping me to reach more and more people and grow the support I can offer them. So it really does mean so much to me. And that comes to Instagram, the likes, the shares, the comments, like anything you can do to help me help you, it would be incredible. I would be so, so grateful. So thank you so much to those who already do it. And if you fancy offering me a little share or a like, then yeah, that would be wonderful too. on a personal note, not loads to report, to be honest. But you know what? I think sometimes that's good, isn't it? Like the sleep is coming and going. We did have a 4:45 a.m. morning the other day, but on the whole, we have been very lucky recently with the sleep. I think that some of Ren's molars are coming through. There's been a lot more chewing, a lot more dribbling than there ever has been, actually. But I have heard that the molars are quite difficult. So I'll be glad when they turn up. And just looking forward, really, to seeing more and more friends and family over the coming weeks as that is allowed. That's, yeah, they're our main focuses. And looking forward to more spring weather, because it has been joyous when the sun has come out, hasn't it? So yeah, hoping for lots more of that. On to today's episode, I am talking to the chairperson of Pregnancy Sickness Support, who talks about the work the charity does to support those experiencing extreme sickness during pregnancies. Caitlin also shares her own experience of it during her pregnancies, which sadly followed loss. Lots of people reached out to me when I shared that this episode was coming, so I'm really glad to be recognising this issue. If there are any other topics you'd like me to cover in the podcast, please, please do reach out to me and ask. Before you do go ahead and listen to this episode, I want to share that there are a couple of trigger warnings. I wasn't aware until Caitlin and I started talking just how extreme the implications of hyperemesis gravidarum could be. And they really are extreme. Caitlin talks of people who have terminated their pregnancies and even attempted to take their own lives due to the symptoms being completely overwhelming. This is clearly a really difficult topic, and I urge you to seek support from Pregnancy Sickness Support if this is something you're experiencing. The help is there, and if you need it, reach out and ask. Please do. I am always here if you need me to, so you know where to find me. It's so important to cover these topics. It is hard to hear some of the information that's shared. I hope that if this is something that does affect you, that hearing this helps you realize you're not alone. And I really hope that there are people out there who perhaps haven't experienced this, but are listening so that they can get a better understanding, because I know that my eyes were firmly, widely opened by our conversation. But anyway, I will leave you to listen, and I really look forward to hearing your feedback. Take care. Bye-bye. Before we start, time for a quick ad break. Knowing your fertile days are so important if you are trying to get pregnant or trying to avoid it. With the Mirror Fertility Tracker, you will know your fertile window up to 6 days. It is the only tracker on the market that provides you an accurate and personalized ovulation analysis by tracking your LH and estrogen hormone levels. Find out more at mirrorcare.com. There's a link in the show notes, and get £25 off your tracker with the code FINALLYPREGNANT. Thank you so much for joining me, Caitlin. I really appreciate it. As I will have said in the preamble, you are the chairperson of Pregnancy Sickness Support. It would be really great to hear from you a bit about the charity and your journey to getting involved as well, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So our charity is UK-wide, but we're based down in a small office in Cornwall. We're a very grassroots organisation operating on a shoestring, really. But we have a helpline and various web systems for getting in touch with us, so that women can contact us for information and support with pregnancy sickness. And obviously, women with sort of regular levels of morning sickness tend not to get in touch with us because they don't generally need help with that. So it does tend to be the extreme end of the spectrum of women who get in touch. And we then have a team of nearly 500 volunteers up and down the country who offer ongoing one-to-one peer support for women who are suffering. And they are all women who have suffered themselves. Or, okay, I'm using the term women, but I'm referring to people. So obviously we do have gender non-specific people who are also supported by us and so on. That's what the charity does. We also raise awareness about the condition, and we do education and training for healthcare professionals, and we're very actively involved in research for hypoemesis. So it's quite diverse, the work that we're doing, but our core is around supporting women with hypoemesis and providing information about the treatments and the services available to them. In terms of how I got involved, so I suffered with my own three children. In our first two pregnancies, I didn't actually find the charity. It existed before I got involved, but it was very small and it didn't really have much of a web presence. So before my third pregnancy, my husband sort of insisted that we get better support. And at that point, I found the charity, went to a small sort of conference event that they put on and got involved as a trustee and drove it forward from there. And I established the support network because it was what I wanted in my pregnancy. So, yeah, and it's grown from there, really. And now we've recently taken on our first CEO, and we've got three members of paid staff who are answering our helpline and web chats. And people can get in touch with us through WhatsApp and social media channels and so on. So we've grown massively, and we're now supporting last year, I think it was over 2,500 women got in touch with us for information and support. And that's the ones who are getting in touch with us. Obviously, there's a lot of women who are using our website and our forum and our social media platforms to get support as well.
Super. And like a lot of people, now I'm going to attempt to say it, hyperemesis gravidarum. I have practiced. Yeah. Woo-woo! But a lot of people, and my only knowledge of it up until very recently, was via Princess Kate. So the Duchess of Cambridge had suffered with this during her pregnancies and was hospitalised. Very recently, I have got a friend who has received incredible support from you guys. So I am eternally grateful to you for that, who has just been absolutely knocked out with this. And I have spoken to her and seen her struggle through this. And hers wasn't a fertility journey, but it's really made the pregnancy very difficult. And so then I've got to thinking about, imagine feeling that lost and that, like, I don't want to put words into her mouth, but, you know, like, you can tell us, but, like, how difficult. And actually, you have told us some stories before we started recording for how severely this affects people. And when you go into it into any pregnancy, you know, having gone through a long journey to get there, whether that be fertility journey or losses or, you know, however that has manifested itself, to then, well, a lot of us don't enjoy our pregnancy, I guess, because we're anxious anyway, but to then have something that is debilitating on top of that already difficult anxiety and everything that comes with it as standard almost. Well, can you tell us some stories that you have heard from people who have reached out to you?
So that's the thing. I mean, when you're suffering hyperemesis, it's understandable and normal to be lying in bed thinking, I just want this pregnancy to end. It's not the pregnancy, it's the sickness that you want to end. But obviously, it's the pregnancy that's making you sick. And, you know, as we mentioned before we started recording, I had my husband and I decided to start trying for a baby shortly after we'd got married. We conceived very quickly, and then I miscarried, and it took another 7 months to conceive again. And when I did, and I remember the first morning about around week six, waking up and throwing up, and my husband and I were like laughing and really pleased, because to us that was like a sign that this one was going to stick in there and I wasn't going to lose it and so on. And within a few days, I hadn't stopped being sick, and I was being sick 20, 30 times a day. And it feels like your entire body has been poisoned. Every cell in your body aches with nausea. And at that point, you know, you end up thinking, well, how can I get through this? Should I end the pregnancy? And then secretly wishing for a miscarriage, which for this much wanted, tried for baby. And, you know, sadly, we have had women who have reached the point who have gone through fertility treatment and IVF and so on, and have ended up terminating their desperately tried for pregnancy because they can't get through it. And very sadly, in recent times, we actually had a woman who reached the point where she'd been through fertility treatment for years. And she reached the point where she felt like her only option was to terminate, but she didn't want to do that. And so she actually made a suicide attempt because she thought, well, I can't live with terminating. It's, you know, better that we both die than not. So, and actually, you know, what's really desperately sad about that is that she was getting really rubbish care from her healthcare professionals. They were not treating her properly. She was not on the whole range of medications that are available to her. She hadn't been referred for mental health support that she should have been. She just was, the care just wasn't there. And actually after the overdose, which wasn't even a particularly severe one, I think, you know, it wasn't, she wasn't going to die from what she'd taken. But at the same time, the healthcare staff then obviously thought that it was probably best if she terminated. And so sort of encouraged her down that route, suggesting that the medications she'd taken will have harmed the baby. And so you might as well end the pregnancy, which was a complete and utter lie. I mean, I know what she turned. It's not, it wasn't a problem and she hadn't harmed the baby, but they just thought, oh, it's, this is, you know, she just needs to end the pregnancy. But she'd been through years of fertility treatment. It's just not acceptable to do that. Anyway, we've slightly digressed on that, but, you know, that's a very shocking, extreme story. But what's not extreme and what is completely normal is for most of our women to be lying in bed thinking about how they can end the pregnancy. It's understandable when you're that ill for that long to consider ways out of that option.
It, like, blows my mind. Like, you did share those stories before we started recording, and literally I was jaw to the floor when you said that. I did not expect that severity, if I'm perfectly honest, and like, apologies for being massively naive, but that is exactly the reason that I want to have episodes like this within the podcast, because I want people to realize that the support is there if this is something they're going through. It's, oh, like, I don't know, like, I can't imagine. I really can't imagine. And I hate saying that. I always remember someone saying to me, if people say they can't imagine, like, it's so bad that you can't even imagine it, you know, like, but that is what it must be like. I can't even imagine how bad it would be that you would consider and actually terminate your pregnancy. Now, I'm assuming, like you said, that that is an extreme, but talk to me about how many people this affects and also why it happens. You know, is there, yeah, is there a test that you can do to assess whether or not this is going to be something that affects you or not? How does that work?
That was a very extreme case, but actually termination is not particularly uncommon for this condition at all. A lot of women do terminate for it, because it is very extreme. And if you can't work, then, you know, you can't pay your bills. If you have other children that you can't look after, and you're not really entitled to any particular benefits because of this and so on. In terms of that extreme, it is still a life-threatening condition. And if it's not treated properly, there can be life-threatening consequences from it. So, you know, you do feel like you're dying, because in the past, women did just die from it until we invented IV fluids and antiemetics and so on. It's a very severe condition, and we don't entirely know why some women suffer and others don't. However, there has been recent research around the genetics of it, and it seems as though it's a genetic thing. Pregnancy sickness in general may well be an evolutionary adaption. It's, you know, we don't really know. It's multifactorial. There could be various different reasons. So women suffer in different ways for different reasons. And there aren't particular risk factors. You know, it's not that if you're, I mean, there are some that are sort of vaguely associated, if you're overweight, if you're underweight, if you're older, if you're younger, blah blah blah, but none of them are particular, you know, they're not real predictors or anything. The only real predictor is that if your mother or sister suffered, then you've got a much higher chance of suffering yourself, because it does seem to have a genetic link. So pregnancy sickness is very much on a spectrum. You've got, you know, everyone's heard of morning sickness, which is a rubbish term because it's not just limited to the morning at all. But that is very much an expected, anticipated, actually hoped for pregnancy. And I suspect your listeners will know that very much, that you think, you know, you kind of look forward to it and want it. And it is, regular pregnancy sickness is associated with a slightly increased chance of the pregnancy being successful. It seems to have a protective factor to it. That's not to say that if you have regular morning sickness that you're, you know, definitely not going to miscarry, but you do have a reduced risk of miscarriage. That stops at the extreme end. With hyperemesis, that protective factor is gone and actually you're at an increased risk. So everyone expects that. Everyone sort of welcomes it. People don't tend to whinge and moan about regular pregnancy sickness because, you know, it's like anticipated. And it's not particularly nice, but it's not particularly bad either. You just get odd waves of nausea, maybe occasional vomiting. Then you've got the moderate to severe nausea and vomiting of pregnancy, which is, you know, you're going to probably need some days off work. It's starting to impact your life. You might lose a bit of weight. You might be struggling to eat and drink normally. And it's pretty miserable and it can go on for quite a few weeks. And at that level, like a first line treatment, medication is probably going to make a really big difference and really help. But then you get hyperemesis, and why some women get that seems to be this genetic sort of fault almost, where we produce, you know, higher levels of a particular substance called GDF15 and various other appetite proteins, and the receptors, the way they're received in the brain, then causes the sickness. So at that level, you know, treatment is necessary, and without it, you're one of the women who 200 years ago would have just died, because you're not able to eat and drink sufficiently. You're losing significant amount of weight, dehydrated, and so on. And then, you know, if you're bed bound, you're at increased risk of things like, you know, deep vein thrombosis and things like that that can cause problems as well. So, I mean, in terms of regular pregnancy sickness, most women suffer that. I mean, the current statistics about 80%, but a recent paper by a colleague who studied it in a slightly different way actually found it was something like 96% or something of women get some nausea in early pregnancy. That's not to say that if you don't get any sickness at all, that it's not a good sign. That's, you know, you can have a pregnancy without any nausea and vomiting, and it is fine. But women can often worry if they don't have any symptoms at all. The sort of the moderate to severe level is around 30% of the population, actually. So really quite a significant amount of women are going to have symptoms that are really not very nice and quite an effort to get through. And then with hyperemesis, you're looking at about 1% of the pregnant population. So not very many, but actually that's still a fair whack of women. it's a lot of people suffer with it. And yet there's so much stigma and misunderstanding and lack of information and lack of knowledge and lack of awareness about it, which is a real battle. And unfortunately, you get this thing where, you know, you've got someone who suffered sort of maybe mild to moderate NVP, NVP being nausea and vomiting of pregnancy, and they're faced with, you know, a friend or a colleague or a patient who has full-blown hyperemesis. And you get this kind of, oh, well, yes, I suffered that, but, you know, I just had to get on with it. I still had to go to work. I didn't have the luxury of lying around in bed. It's like, but you didn't suffer it. Can you not understand that there's this spectrum and that I have it way worse than what you had? But it seems to be, you know, like something that's hard for people to understand. And I mean, the fact that you're trying to imagine it is brilliant. A lot of people don't even try and imagine how awful it must be. And that's a real battle that a lot of women find, that they just are not validated about this condition and that it's just dismissed and it's just seen as a regular part of pregnancy. And like we were saying before we started recording as well, like a lot of women, certainly I had this comment umpteen million times during my pregnancies, well, at least you can get pregnant, you know. And actually, if you're at the point of, well, you may well have gone through a whole battle to even conceive in the first place. So hearing that is, you know, it's reassuring, but it's also like, do you think I'm not grateful? Are you accusing me of not being grateful for being pregnant? I'm seriously ill. Like, yes, I'm grateful that I'm pregnant, but I'm suffering here, you know. And they just kind of can't understand that. And it's a really unhelpful comment. And then, I mean, I also know I've come across women who have no babies because of hyperemesis, because they have not managed to successfully get through a pregnancy. And there's a lot of women who, yes, okay, they've done it once, they've got through it once and they have one child. And yes, they're grateful for that. But they always dreamed of having a family with two or three or four children. And this condition means that they cannot have any more children. And that's really, you know, that needs to be appreciated and recognised as, for what it is. And so those kind of comments are really unhelpful.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And, you know, a lot of that almost is very similar in some ways to fertility, you know, that you want more children, and the grief around not being able to have more, any to start with. And then if you do, you know, you are lucky enough to have one or two, but you want two or three, or but actually you're not able to because of your condition. You know, the parallels there are, you know, and the grief around that and the insensitivity and misunderstanding from people who care but just don't get it, you know, that there are an awful lot of parallels there for sure.
There are, and even with the termination thing, so we actually had a woman I know who, she terminated her pregnancy as an absolute last resort. She was, you know, it was desperately wanted pregnancy, and she ended up terminating, and she asked if she could access the sort of they had a grief midwife who deals particularly with sort of after miscarriages and so on, but fetal where they've had to terminate because of fetal anomalies and things like that. And the grief for termination for high premises is very similar to the grief of terminating for fetal anomaly, except that you've got all this additional guilt of there wasn't actually anything wrong with the baby. So, you know, it's there's a whole additional level of guilt there. And so this woman went for her appointment with the grief midwife counsellor woman. And this midwife was like, sorry, I don't really understand, but you chose to end your pregnancy. So why are you here speaking to me? It's like unbelievable, you know, utterly unbelievable. Yeah, like.
Especially from a professional as well, having that thought that they haven't put any, you know, and our medical professionals, and you are one of, you know, like they do such an amazing job. And I appreciate that they can't do everything and cover every aspect. But reading a file, and we go through this so much with fertility treatment, and a lot of the fertility patients out there will be nodding along to this, you know, read my file before I walk into the room, like understand why I'm here, please, you know, like as a minimum.
Don't expect me to go through it again. Yeah, don't expect me to go through it all over again every blinking time.
Exactly. Like it's just so hard. And like what can, so my close experience with this now, like I said, is with a very good friend of mine, and who is just like one of the most incredible women that I know. You know, she is an absolute powerhouse. She would not agree with that herself, I know, but she is. She is like, I was trying to think of a word for her. She's just a warrior, and not in the kind of fertility sense or anything like that, you know, because that isn't her journey, but she just is like just one of life's amazing women. And she was floored by it completely. And she did. She was lucky enough to reach out to you guys. And and that's amazing. But what care can people who that happens to, like literally can't get out of bed, what care is there out there for emotional and medical? Like, obviously, you're not going to talk, you know, prescriptions.
No, I can talk you through the treatments as well. Because, I mean, what's so frustrating for us is when women come to us having already terminated and they say, oh, well, you know, my doctor said that there was nothing I could take, so I didn't see that I had any choice. And it's like, oh, yeah, there were medications you could take. Or they said, my doctor said that I'd run out of options, that I took all the medications. And so we go through what they took, and it's like they tried like two first-line medications, and they just didn't even know that there were other options. And that's not entirely the, you know, like you say, there are lots of very excellent healthcare professionals out there, and, you know, they can't know everything about everything. And, you know, it's not the doctors aren't deliberately like lying. It's just that they just don't know, because they can't know everything about everything. So but as a result, a part of what we do is empower women to know what their options are, and they can then go and speak to their healthcare professional and say, well, I know you're saying that I've tried everything, but actually I've heard that I could try these other things, you know, and how to ask for a referral on if my GP isn't confident and is saying I don't want to prescribe anything in pregnancy. It's like, okay, that's fine, but you need to refer me to a consultant at the hospital then who is willing to prescribe. So it's just sort of empowering women to know what they can and can't do. So there are a number of treatments available, from sort of first line anti-sickness tablets that have been around for decades. Of course, there's a stigma, because I'm sure lots of your listeners will have heard of thalidomide, which was a drug that came out in the 50s and 60s and caused profound, terrible, terrible birth defects. Really, you know, it was an absolute tragedy what went on there. And part of the problem is that even when they started to realize that this was being caused by this medication, it continued to get prescribed in pregnancy. And it was prescribed for like almost anything pregnancy related. But one of the indications was nausea and vomiting. And as a result of that, there's this huge stigma around taking medication in pregnancy, particularly for pregnancy sickness. And there's also this idea that the baby in the first trimester is this tiny little kind of parasite thing that can take what it needs from mum, and that, you know, even if you're starving and losing weight, the baby's fine. And we do actually know from research now that that's complete and utter nonsense, and that losing significant weight in the first trimester is associated with more negative birth outcomes and lifelong complications potentially for the offspring. Because it's all very well saying it takes what it needs from mum, but actually if you've been sick for 3 weeks and barely eaten anything, then you are depleted in, you know, all your B vitamins and, you know, various micronutrients. And if they're not there, then it can't take them. So you've got to balance the risk of medications versus the risk of starving and being dehydrated and so on for the baby as well as for mum. So yeah, there's first line medications which have been around for decades, since the time of thalidomide, and you know, they've got mountains of research behind them. They've never been able to find an association with any, you know, negative outcomes for the baby. So, you know, and there are large data sets looking at that, and if it was causing major problems, it would have been spotted by now. So you can never say never, but you can say, like, we've looked and we can't find harm caused by these. Then there's second line treatments. Like there's a medication that's used for chemotherapy, nausea and vomiting that a lot of people have heard of called ondansetron. It's really quite an effective medication. With that, it's one of the most researched medications now for this condition. And again, they cannot find any problems other than there's a possible association with an additional 3 in 10,000 oral clefts. So you're talking... So in the baseline, in the population generally, you occasionally get these things. And so in a general population of healthy pregnant women, you're going to see around 11 in 10,000 oral clefts. And in women who have been exposed, in babies who have been exposed to ondansetron in the first trimester, they saw 14 in 10,000 as opposed to 11 in 10,000. So an additional 3. One of the problems with suggesting that that is because of the ondansetron is you've got to bear in mind that women who are taking ondansetron in pregnancy, by the time they're prescribed it, are probably already deficient in various micronutrients, including things like folic acid, which is also associated. If you don't take folic acid, you also have an increased risk of having a baby with an oral cleft. So you know, the chances are it's the malnutrition as opposed to the ondansetron. But that's the only thing. They, you know, looking in these huge data sets, they cannot find problems with, you know, heart defects or any limb problems or any other congenital malformations. So, you know, I mean, to me, as a woman who suffered hyperemesis, that's like that drug, that's as safe as you can get. You know, my alternative is to terminate or, you know, or 3 in 10. But we're at the position now where, because of this 3 in 10,000, a lot of women do get refused it in the first trimester. And, you know, it's just an utter madness that a doctor would prefer to terminate a baby than provide a medication which is entirely safe other than this 3 in 10,000 oral clefts. That's 9,997 babies that won't have it. So yeah, so that's the, so there's that. And then you can also combine these medications and use them together, because some of them have different actions and different ways of working. And then a third line, if that's not enough, is that we use steroids. And I think we think that they probably give a boosting effect to the other medications. So it's good to stay on the other anti-sickness medications and add in the steroid. That's sort of the ultimate with our treatment options. And then, of course, it's getting IV fluids and having access to a hospital or IV at home so that you can, you know, if you're not managing to keep fluid down, you can get access to an IV drip. Again, that can be a real challenge for this condition, just to be believed that you're dehydrated not by choice and that it's not as simple as just going home and drinking water. But it's, yeah, that can be a battle for women as well, even just accessing that treatment at all, really. So yeah, so there's that. There's lots of options there. And so if your doctor's saying that there is nothing you can take, that's not true. And as you know, on a risk-benefit balance, the meds are safer than weight loss in pregnancy. And then there's emotional support, and that's largely where we come in as an organisation. So we can, it's such a lonely, isolating condition that, you know, and if you're already feeling isolated and from friends because you've been through fertility treatment while they've all been, you know, happily producing their offspring, you may already feel a bit isolated on that sort of stuff. And then you suffer this and you are literally bedbound in a dark room just trying to get through every day. It's a very, very lonely, dark place to be. And with all sorts of negative thoughts, as we've talked about already. And so that's where we come in. We understand, we validate, we say, yes, you are genuinely ill and you are entitled to treatment and support and care and compassion. And we can then match with women who have been through it, put you in a WhatsApp group with various volunteers if you need a lot of input. And it's just someone to check in with you, see how you're doing, you know, a shoulder to cry on, someone to laugh with when your mother-in-law suggests ginger's going to cure this. Or that you just need to think positively and be grateful that you're pregnant at all. You know, it's that kind of thing. And we do have volunteers who have suffered following fertility treatments. We have volunteers who have, you know, been through pregnancy loss at all and every stage, really, and so on. So we try and match on that a bit so that, you know, you're matched with someone who has similar experiences and understands where you're coming from and understands those, you know, that awful place where you're so scared of going to the loo and seeing blood, but at the same time you're so ill, this little deep bit in the back of your brain kind of almost wants it because you just want this to be over. So we understand all of that, I guess, and that's where we can support.
It's brilliant. It really is. I've just got one other question for you, really. And that is, you know, morning sickness, traditionally, obviously not morning, and unfortunately, not necessarily just in the first trimester. Now, I know that it can go on into the second trimester. Is this something that some people do experience all the way through, or is there a respite that you can get to, you know, at some stage?
With sort of regular pregnancy sickness, usually that will ease off 12, 14 weeks, possibly lingers on to kind of the 20-week point. With moderate to severe pregnancy sickness, it usually goes on to more like 20 weeks. And then hopefully you'll recover and get on with a regular pregnancy. With full-blown hyperemesis, unfortunately, it does tend to go on and on and on. And some women will make complete recoveries around 20, 24 weeks and go on to have a normal, healthy, happy, enjoyable pregnancy. But unfortunately, for a lot of women, it does linger on. It's quite unusual for it to be very, very severe throughout the entire pregnancy. What's more common is you get to sort of the 20, 24 week mark. Hopefully by then you're on plenty of medication to get it under control and so on. And it may be that the rest of the pregnancy is what everyone else would describe as sort of normal pregnancy sickness. And yeah, for a lot of women, it goes right on until delivery, and then it goes, hopefully. If it doesn't, you need to get in touch with us, because there can be, you know, lingering problems, gastrointestinal problems and so on. But for the absolute vast majority, as soon as that pregnancy is over, that it goes. And actually for me, it was this incredible experience where, I mean, even when in the later part of the pregnancy, you have days where you kind of think, oh yeah, that was a good day, I felt pretty normal today. And it wasn't until I was no longer pregnant that I thought, wow, even those good days, they were bad. Because literally, with each of them, actually, it was when the placenta came out. And in my second one, that took quite a while, and the baby was out of me and I was still being sick. And I was going, oh my God, the baby's out and I'm still throwing up. What the hell's going on? And then I literally sort of felt the placenta detach and come away. And it's like I've been wearing a 20 kilo rucksack for 9 months, constantly sleeping in it, doing everything in it. And then someone just lifts it off your back and it just like lifted. The sickness just lifted away from me. And I was like, it's gone. I feel normal. I don't feel sick. And I realized then that even those good days where I thought I'd felt fairly normal were not normal. They were a heavy cloud of nausea every single day throughout the entire pregnancy. And with my third, I remember the next day being up in the kitchen and I just, you know, wanting to just eat food suddenly tasted normal again, because it's not just the sickness and the nausea. Everything smells horrific. Every stuff doesn't taste normal. Water doesn't taste normal. The smell of your other children can make you sick. And that all of that just went. And I was in the kitchen the next day making my own cup of tea, feeling, you know, great and normal. And my husband looked at me and went, "Oh, you're back. You're back. Look, you've got a twinkle in your eyes again." And, you know, it hadn't been me for 9 months. It had been hyperemesis for 9 months.
And you're right there. And we won't go into this in lots of detail, but if you're going through this with a partner, it affects them as well, doesn't it? Because if they're wanting to feel joyous about the pregnancy, if they're wanting to feel, you know, like, and they're looking at someone who is sick and not enjoying it. And so it does affect both of the people in that partnership, doesn't it? Which I guess can also, it's another layer of guilt for someone who's going through it, isn't it?
Yeah. It is, yeah, very much so. And for dads, partners, sorry. I mean, you know, we've had partners who, you know, nip home at lunchtime from work, coming in the door thinking, am I going to find her dead? And they're just absolutely terrified. And for them, it's like I would choose my partner over the baby. And they see it from that external and they think this baby's killing her. And I don't want her to be this ill. And it's really difficult. And we've had dads who have trauma afterwards and, you know, are too scared to have sex with their partner because they are terrified of getting her pregnant. And so it can destroy marriages on that front, you know, like, I mean, for my husband we don't do permission stuff in our marriage. Like, so I don't like that language around letting me have another pregnancy, but obviously it was a joint decision. And for him, it was just that, I can't believe you're willing to go through that again. And I don't want to see you suffer like that again, you know? And one of my very good friends at the time said to me, like, please don't do this. You can't get through another pregnancy like this. He said, look, I will ask you not to do this, but if you are going to do it, I will support you. And that meant the world to me. And he's my little girl's godfather now. And it was just, you know, he didn't want me to do it, but he recognised that if I was going to do it, that I needed the support. So yeah, it's tough on those around you as well. And the partners have to pick up the pieces, you know, make ends meet financially, you know, provide the childcare. It can be difficult even to manage the household because, you know, when you've got hyperemesis, any cooking smells, you could be upstairs in bed. And if someone opens the fridge downstairs, there's nothing bad in there. Like, to a non-pregnant person, the fridge doesn't smell of anything, but she can smell the stuff in there from upstairs. And so, you know, dads end up having to like go microwave their food and eat in the garage and things like that. And when the smell of your partner, who's the only person that can offer you that comfort at times when you're so isolated from everyone else, when the smell of them makes you feel sick and you need them to sleep in the spare bedroom because any movement on the bed triggers vomiting and the smell of them and all of that just adds to the isolation and they feel so helpless. We do offer support for partners as well. And we're looking at the moment actually about setting up a sort of WhatsApp group for partners who are going through it. And I was thinking about maybe doing some online sessions about things like how to advocate for your partner, because my husband had it. I remember in the GP surgery in my first pregnancy, being faced with this doctor. I'd just come out of hospital and I was on medications I was having some side effects from. And he basically took me off the medications and said, you shouldn't be taking medication in pregnancy. He said, it's normal to be sick 2 or 3 times a day, Caitlin. You just need to pull yourself together. And I was a practice nurse at the time. This was a GP I'd worked with professionally. So that was, you know, quite hard. And he said, yeah, it's normal. You just need to pull yourself together. And I was just sitting there in tears. I couldn't even speak. I felt too nauseous to speak. And we walked out and my husband said to me, but you're not being sick 2 or 3 times a day. You're being sick 20 to 30 times a day. And I looked at him and I said, why didn't you say that? I just wished he'd said that to the doctor, because I couldn't speak. But he just felt too overwhelmed by the situation. He didn't know how to advocate for me. He just thought that what the doctor says goes, and he didn't know how to sort of defend me and stick up for me. And so and there are ways partners can do that using proper measures, for example. So a partner can be very helpful if, for example, you monitor her urine output and, you know, buy a measuring jug, stick it in the loo and tell her to wee in it, and then you'll deal with it. And just keep a track of how much she's weeing, because actually that gives you a really solid number to go to the doctor and say, she has only passed 100 mil of urine in the last 24 hours. She is dehydrated. I don't, there's this issue with ketones being measured and stuff. And you could, but if a dad has that, or, you know, using a bottle that you know is the volume of liquid in it, and monitoring, keeping track of how much she's actually drinking and keeping down, and being able to say to the doctor, you know, I've been providing her drinks for her, and I know she has only had 100 mil or 200 mils of fluid in the last 24 hours, and she's only weed this amount. It's hard for a doctor to ignore that. And I think for partners, that's quite a sort of tangible, measurable, actionable thing to do that's very proactive and helpful.
That's great. Yeah. And people can come and find out more about that from you. What can people do if they know someone who's going through this? So the first thing is make sure they know that pregnancy sickness support exists and that they have contacted you. What else can people do to support someone going through this?
So I don't want to sound too negative, but a lot of it's about what you don't do. So, for example, please don't suggest ginger. She will have been suggested ginger by everyone else. and it doesn't help with hyperemesis, and it can make it worse. So don't, you know, turn up with ginger biscuits or ginger beer or ginger capsules or anything else. Don't tell her at least you can get pregnant. Don't, you know, tell her that you had it, but you had to just get on with it and things like that. And that it will be worth it in the end. And she just needs to think positively. What you can do is just message every day, how are you doing? Because she's lonely. She's spending entire days in bed while you're off at work. Message her, check in with her, validate what she's going through. It sounds horrific. I can't imagine how awful this must be for you. If she's been through fertility, gosh, how this must be so awful for you after everything you've been through, to now be suffering like this must just be awful. Validate that she is genuinely ill. This isn't a normal part of pregnancy that you just have to put up with. You are genuinely unwell. Have you spoken to your doctor? Would it be helpful if I came with you to the doctor and advocated for you? Would it be helpful? You know, how can I help? Can I take your other children? Obviously, in COVID times, it's difficult. But women, if you're ill, you can childcare bubble. That is a legitimate legal thing, is to get help with childcare. You know, would it be helpful for me to take the children out? Would it be helpful for me to drop some meals off for your family? Can I do some shopping? You know, if you do pop round, and, you know, make sure that you don't leave any washing up in the sink. If you nip to the loo, give it a quick clean. Vomiting in a clean toilet is a lot nicer than vomiting in a not clean toilet. You know, things like that, that just help. And if you are going to visit her, make sure you don't wear perfume. You don't smell of cigarette smoke or anything else that's strong, because that perfume is nice when you're not pregnant and it smells lovely on you. But to her, it probably is warped and smells horrific. Don't go and visit her the day after you've had a curry or anything that's very heavily garliced. practical things, like if she's got other children and they're going to nursery, and they get fed at nursery. I mean, in my second pregnancy, we actually asked the nursery to make sure that that my eldest, Alfie, didn't have any garlic in his meal at lunchtime, because I could smell him from when he came in the door. And it would mean that I couldn't see him, that I couldn't give him a cuddle. I couldn't spend the 10 minutes that I could spend with him if he smelt of garlic from having had, you know, garlic bread with lasagna at lunchtime. So my husband went and spoke to the nursery, and they made sure that he didn't have garlic bread and whatever. So, yeah, so just don't, try not to smell. And just, you know, just offer to help and just be a listening ear and, you know, just say, I'm not going to suggest ginger, and I'm not going to tell you to think positively. This must be really hard and you are genuinely ill, but you will get through this, and we can get you through this. And I'm here for you. You don't have to do this alone.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you sharing your story and, you know, for everything you do for everyone. And like, you know, from my personal point of view, for my friend, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it.
And thank you so much for what you're doing, because I have friends who are struggling with fertility. And, you know, that journey once you get pregnant is just so wrought with anxiety. And I mean, I had two miscarriages, and they were, you know, fairly early. The second one was quite an interesting one, because I knew that it wasn't right, because I wasn't sick. And in fact, I felt how I felt after a pregnancy, as in I felt better even than normal. And everyone was telling me, oh, just think positively. Oh, you're just going to not get it this time. I'm just like, you're not listening to me. That's just not realistic. And then, of course, it was, and I went for an early scan, and they were like, oh, you're just earlier than you think you are. And I'm like, well, unless conception doesn't happen the way I believe it happens, then I'm definitely the right amount of pregnant that I think I am. So your scan obviously is showing that this is not developing properly. And then, you know, a few weeks later, it was a miscarriage. And I had to go through the taking the tablets and so on. And yeah, that, you know, everyone sort of telling me that it wasn't, that I was just lucky this time and so on. It was just like, you just aren't listening to me. You're not believing me here. But yeah, after miscarriages, that pregnancy is so fraught with anxiety. And it's really great that that this is out here for those women, because it is like, once you get pregnant, you're sort of like a bit forgotten that it's, you know, well, now you're just a normal pregnant person.
Oh yeah, you're fixed. Like, you're fixed.
Yeah, you're fixed. And, and actually it's like, you have no idea how terrifying going to the loo is every single time, you know, and things like that. So it's great that you're doing this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Super. All right then. Well, it's been really lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much. So take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.